I shall now attempt to read the statement that's come out, and after that, representatives of the four groups that have drawn it up will be speaking briefly to each section. I think that's right, isn't it? So, here we are. Statement to be presented to the UK negotiators at Copenhagen, December 2009. As young people of the Christian and Islamic faiths, we call upon those negotiating on our behalf in Copenhagen to acknowledge our voice and to attend to the critical matters of human-made climate change with urgency and vigor. Although we are individuals from a great many backgrounds, ideals, and variances of faith, we draw upon our collective moral and religious conscience to take responsibility for the condition of our planet and its people. We are aware of the evidence, understand the issues, and recognize that global warming will produce numerous unacceptable repercussions. In particular, we are aware that changes in our climate will have disproportionate effects on the poor and irreversible consequences for future generations. Our faith obligates us to care for the earth and to attend to those who are in need. And as our representatives, we call on you to take heed of this and act effectively. First, to help mitigate climate change. As a growing number of your constituents who are ready, willing, and able to do our part in mitigating the effects of climate change, we are calling on you to lead us in immediate action. Action must start now. It is unacceptable that the large majority of the country do not know the true extent of climate change, and we call on you to address this through developing a stronger awareness at all levels, individuals, communities, and businesses. To drive these changes, we want to see stronger incentives through policy for more sustainable practices and deterrence, especially through greater accountability and penalties. We demand more investment and a refocus toward greener technology and innovation, as well as an awareness of the effects of the total production process. Furthermore, we demand a fair global deal with developing countries taking the lead in responsibility. Failure to act adequately will affect future generations. Second, to help us adapt to climate change. We ask that all people are educated on climate change to give them the knowledge that they need to engage with strategy and policy making, and that knowledge and good practices developed locally are shared and fed into government strategy and policies for adaptation. A conducive political and economic system needs to be pursued that removes barriers to adaptation, such as trade justice, provision of sufficient resources, money, technology, skills, and transparency. We ask that your approach to the negotiations in Copenhagen ensures that local economies and agriculture are developed. More policymakers should work with farmers, equipping them to keep food in production locally, to maintain ecosystems and biodiversity communities. Communities are facilitated to share resources and empowered to work together on the ground. Policymakers need also to recognize that faith-based organizations are a catalyst for empowerment and delivery. Third, to tackle the issues on funding our response to climate change. When signing the United Nations Convention, countries agreed to the principle that as developed countries with worldwide climate debt, they are morally, politically, and legally obligated to take full financial responsibility for their actions. This responsibility should be twofold: in ensuring that our future development puts climate justice at its center, alongside enabling countries in the South to fulfill their right to develop. $200 billion a year is urgently required to tackle this critical environmental crisis. This should be raised through public finance and administered by the UN to ensure transparency and democratic representation of all nations. We see no place for the World Bank's involvement in raising the required funds. We need to make it explicit that this is not charity, but a historical debt that developed nations have incurred through overconsumption. It is clear that this is achievable based on the recent bailout of financial institutions costing $3 to $7 trillion and the Iraq war, which cost $1 trillion. We call for developed nations to commit a minimum of 1% of their GDP to climate finance without conditionality. Just financial implementation is necessary, using the most appropriate community-based and sustainable solutions to lead to a low-carbon future. These include partnering with faith groups and young people who are the future generation. They will be left with the consequences of inaction. Communities can propagate and maintain hope, raise awareness and morale, I think, and contribute to a changed mindset. Furthermore, they can promote a rights-based approach to climate change based upon shared belief, openness, responsibility, and accountability. We believe in a global Green Deal that will deliver real economic benefits for all. Fourth, technology transfer. Technology is the right of all, and as we are called to be stewards of nature, so we are also called to be good stewards of the ideas and technology that we have developed. This is a crucial time for the Global North to use their technologies in partnership with the Global South to ensure growth on an environmentally positive pathway. Western countries are too possessive of technology, so we need to give access to our resources. This should include the creation of a fund to buy out patents and restructuring patents to take advantage of the long-term benefits of their utilization by developing countries. Governments need to commit to investments through small businesses and social entrepreneurs to provide green, sustainable jobs and transferring technology abroad, which will have long-term benefits to all, including themselves and all other stakeholders. Accountability and responsibility should be undertaken by a partnership of stakeholders, including world leaders, grassroots community leaders, faith leaders, NGOs, and business people. These proposals will instill a sense of justice which is not defined by short-term economic incentives. There is your statement, and I think you should applaud yourselves. I'm now going to invite each of the four groups responsible for this to take their turn in commenting a bit about what was behind the paragraph that they drafted. And I think the first is going to be the mitigation workshop.
Thank you, Archbishop. In our discussions this morning, we talked a lot about what it means to mitigate the effects of climate change and who we are mitigating the effects for and in what way. I think really just to emphasize a couple of the key points that came out of our statement, which the Archbishop read. We talked about the importance of leadership, the fact that people in the UK understand the issues, they know about the issues to some extent, and yet at the moment there is this value action gap. There's a gap between what people have some awareness of and action. And so we really felt that there was real benefit in strong leadership from government in encouraging positive behaviour change. We talked a little about the need for systemic change, the need to consider things more holistically, to when we're looking at certain aspects of the debate, at technologies, at resources, to try to take a whole systems approach, because otherwise we end up with a piecemeal approach to these problems, which doesn't amount to much more than a sticking plaster in certain places. We talked about the need to increase and improve people's access to education and information and awareness of issues. There's a danger that with only a superficial engagement in these issues, people can quickly become disenchanted, disenfranchised from these issues. Finally, we talked about the real importance of what we called a just engagement. We need to engage all parties. We need to engage the developing world, the countries in the South that have traditionally been not included in negotiations, in technology transfer, and really to move towards an engagement which sees those parties as equal partners in discussions and in moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. So we move on to the adaptation workshop.
Thank you, Archbishop. In our group, we We had a lot of debate about where the knowledge about adaptation and where the resources for adaptation need to flow from. And we discussed what the locals themselves can offer in places where adaptation to climate change is most needed. We decided that a lot of the time it's these locals that have the knowledge, the local knowledge of their situation, of what the problems are exactly, and also have a good idea about the solutions and that they need to be listened to. We then talked about what we in the developed world should offer. And in terms of resources, it depends on what is needed for particular local contexts. And there's a lot of types of resources that we discussed, such as money and skills, research and expertise. Then we went on to talk about how to implement resource transfer. And we said that we need to ensure that the resources actually trickle down to the grassroots where the adaptation is most needed. And in this particular category, we talked about the importance of faith communities, because faith communities in the developing world often have a reach to the grassroots level and to the people, which many governments do not have. And in this way, they can play a vital part in not only delivering ideas and messages about climate change and about how to adapt, but also in the practical delivery and implementing of the adaptation itself. We then went on to talk about the bigger picture and about the need to empower. We need to provide a system which is conducive to adaptation to climate change. There's a lot of examples that we mentioned of communities trying to adapt but facing barriers such as lack of transparency, such as corruption, such as a lack of trade justice. And we think that the climate change agenda needs to be incorporated into other agendas such as the trade justice debate. The importance of agriculture was quite clear in our debates. And the need to secure livelihoods. The adaptation to climate change needs to deal with people and with their livelihoods and with how climate change has affected them and the way they live and the livelihood they can gain. We played an interesting game in our group, which was a role play, where we put ourselves in the shoes of different people who are having to deal with climate change. And this helped us to really appreciate how local contexts are really important. Adapting to climate change can mean completely different things in different areas and to different people. And it also showed us how often those who are most affected by climate change are the poorest, and that adaptation needs to be focused towards their livelihoods. Finally, we had a little bit of a controversial debate about types of adaptation, whether we should focus adaptation on helping people continue their existing lifestyles and cultures, or whether we should also encourage adaptation which is a change of circumstances as a result of climate change, such as migration and such. Overall, we really emphasized the local context, and I think this is the main thing that came out of our debates.
Thank you very much indeed. The third group was looking at funding issues.
Okay, so feeding on from actually what the adaptation and mitigation groups said, we kind of concluded in our section that we felt that focus on the community and on empowerment and local peoples is crucial in tackling climate change, and that positive behavioural change is definitely needed. And within that, there's an urgency, and we need to act now. And that, with regard to funding, that means changing our mindset very, very quickly. And we talked about events such as, 9/11, where basically the whole world changed the way that they viewed, issues of security, and in the space of a few days, and that we have a human capacity to be able to change that mindset very, very quickly if we want to. And the same is relevant here with regard to climate change. And in finding the space and the ability to access funds, we talked about areas where that you might be able to access that money and that there is an availability and we can act on it if we want to. But obviously we recognize that that requires a great deal of will, which is where that comes into the communities, and that there needs to be a balance between government incentives and community will behind those actions. We think that we need to have a rights-based approach to dealing with climate change, and that's very important. And that with regards to financial issues, we have to, more developed countries have to accept the responsibility in the part that they played, and that we need to find a balance. But obviously that's going to be quite complex, so that's where, again, you need to feed into local people to understand it entirely.
Thank you very much. And the fourth and final section on technology transfer.
Thank you, Archbishop. Just to demonstrate how we were thinking through this particularly complex issue of technology transfer, I've asked Nadim just to show the thinking processes that we went through to really let you feel how we were engaging with this issue of how we share our resources and what we know as the Global North with the people in the Global South. So first of all, we split it up into what technology to do what and for who. And initially, we grappled with the issues around technology transfer to places like China and India, where they will have technology themselves, and how we would then relate to that. For example, this gave us the idea of partnership, that just simply donating what we have isn't going to work. We've got to see what technologies are available in the Global South as well. And this was the idea of incentives and the idea of really engaging in partnership. This bottom point, which I'll read out, it's a longer-term view and a 20-year perspective. The idea at this point was in the engagement of intellectual property rights, whenever somebody has their patent of their idea, how we then legitimately give that away. If we simply donate it, then there is no incentive for the people in the Global North or universities and professors to develop new ideas and fresh technologies. So this was a useful idea in the group of developing a system of restructuring patents, as well as simply giving them away. For example, giving them immediate access, but in 20 years or after the patent has been proven to show effectiveness and even financial delivery for those in the Global South, that then the patent holder can reclaim a percentage or a portion of profits. This is the idea of accountability and how we actually go about creating structures that make technology transfer legitimate. For example, here, slide, we extrapolated to the portion in the document about an idea of a partnership of NGOs, of faith leaders, of overall political leaders to really look at this issue whenever it's going on, to hold it accountable. And again, we can skip that one. These are just some of the ideas that we were going through. And we came to the idea of structuring the statement itself. First, putting into context our basis, the reasons for why we think technology transfer is a good idea, the importantness of stewardship of the resources and ideas and intellectual capital that we have as Christians and Muslims and people in the Global North. We then identified the problems because technology transfer, we're quite possessive in the West. We discussed amongst our group of the ideas we have that it would be a real waste of resources for them to simply try to copy what we've already done, when what we have can really help those people in the Global South. And this led on to our solutions page, which was the key focus of our paragraph on technology transfer. We were talking about access, about creating the right incentives for both development of intellectual property and for the actual use of it in the Global South. accountability, and issues around the social entrepreneurs, people in the grassroots, that they're going to have access to these particular ideas and innovations and then use them in their communities. We could see the three themes from these particular ideas, the values of the injustice, that we have things that we can help other people in the Global South with, that we don't need to hold on to for ourselves. And that links into the need or responsibility that we have as stewards to share these technologies, and the benefits for all if we do share these particular ideas and innovations for not just those people who are receiving, but an overall globalized society of increased wealth and prosperity for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I think it's been wonderful to have these background expositions of what's been clearly some very tough and sophisticated thinking on the part of the groups. And there are a number of points coming out which I think are of immense importance for all of us. We've been encouraged to take a long-term view, which may at first hearing sound as if it softens the urgency. I think the opposite is true. I think the urgency is to make sure that we do have a long-term sustainable perspective. What is urgent is getting it right for the long term, so to speak, not just instant reactive short-term stuff. And I think that's been an important dimension of everything that's been said. I think the stress on education has been extremely useful here. And I noted with great interest some of the thinking about patents that was mentioned, and the whole emphasis on what I suppose in my generation, when we're thinking about some of these issues, we used to call appropriate technology rather than the technological quick fix. And that's a very, very central idea in all this. But perhaps most basic in all that we've heard has been the idea that this is essentially about responsibility in several different ways. And maybe that is where the religious and ethical perspective most comes alive. First of all, negatively, it's about encouraging ourselves, as people living in the prosperous bit of the world, to take responsibility for choices made over generations that have led us to where we are, and responsibility for the effects of our current style of life on the rest of the world now. That kind of responsibility, which is, if you like, the bad news, because it's going to be costly. The second kind of responsibility is the good news, and that is saying to those who may seem to be helpless in the world, actually, you have some possibilities of action, and we are committed to helping you grow into the responsibility that you need to shape your own lives constructively and creatively. And I think that balance of the negative and the positive side of responsibility, that is very much what all of us would want to say on the basis of our faith. We are responsible before God. We are held accountable for the destructive patterns of our action. We are also, by God's grace, given a liberty to change ourselves around and a liberty to help other people into greater liberty. Now that, I think, is a worthy principle on which to settle, and it's been brought into focus by everything that's been said by those who've been drafting this statement, and I, for one, am very grateful to hear it. We're now going to take a short break to get some tea or coffee, I think, after which we'll take some closing reflections and see where we go. I think the statement, as you've heard it, is quite an achievement in rapid short-term drafting, and I really do congratulate all those who've been involved in that. It'll need little bits of fine-tuning here and there and the odd comma put in, maybe, but that's fine. That you've got so far is a tremendous achievement, and I'm delighted to see it.